You're listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio.
So I drove to the University of New Hampshire and said I'd like to speak to the director of admissions. She said, well, I'm sorry, you don't have an appointment. And I said, no, that's okay. I'll just sit here and wait. So after about 2 hours, she came over and said, he's not going to be able to see you. And I said, no problem. I brought a book. And she finally looked at me and said, you're not leaving, are you? Well, she finally said, okay, he'll see you. And he said, okay, this is not consistent with our rules. However, if you get me an application in, if it qualifies, I'll let you in. I hustled and he let me in. In the arrogance of youth, I didn't think to really thank him. Years later, I reconnected with him, thanked him. 3 years after that, he was awarded New Hampshire's highest civilian honor, and he asked me to be the guy presenting it to him.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. And while we are still in this pandemic-fueled economic downturn, those frontiers can look scary. And there are often more questions than answers. Today we have as our guest someone who has navigated waters like this before and is a legendary American business executive. And if anyone has useful insights, it's him. Welcome Dave Cote, retired and legendary chairman and CEO of Honeywell, and now the executive chairman of Vertiv Holdings. He also has a new book coming out soon, which we will dig into as well. Dave has a remarkable success story. Born and grew up in a small town, New Hampshire environment, French-Canadian background, and even spoke French his first few years. He bounced around before he finally finished college and joined GE, where he had a long and successful career in the Jack Welch years. He was not picked as Jack's successor, which Jack told me later was one of his biggest mistakes. But that did not slow Dave down. Dave went on to be CEO of TRW and then to a long run as CEO of Honeywell, where he grew the company's market value from $20 billion to $120 billion during his tenure. He's been a major voice in Washington for business over his entire career. Dave loves music, people, and the outdoors. Dave, welcome.
Nice to be here, Bob.
Before we get into the meat of it, Dave, I'd like to do you in a feature we called You in 60 Seconds. You ready?
Sure.
Do you prefer Beatles or Stones?
Oh, Beatles.
New Hampshire or New York?
New Hampshire.
Sunrise or sunset?
Sunset.
Basketball or football?
Ugh. Basketball.
Spring or fall?
Fall.
Hunting or fishing?
Ugh. Fishing.
David Ortiz or Tom Brady?
Tom Brady.
Sweet or savory?
Sweet.
Scuba diving or skiing?
Scuba.
Pop or hip-hop music?
Pop.
It's about to get harder. Childhood hero?
Bill Russell.
First job?
Picking blueberries.
Craziest job you ever had?
Digging cellar holes after the house had been constructed.
Secret talent?
Well, as I've described it, I seem to always know what other people should be doing.
Favorite artist?
Probably John Lennon.
Historical figure you'd like to meet?
Oh, George Washington.
Title of your memoir?
Winning Now, Winning Later.
Favorite food?
Lobster.
First concert?
Moody Blues.
If you have one superpower, what would you want it to be?
Wow. I guess the ability to make people happy.
That's a good one. Let's jump in. You weathered the last two big recessions in the driver's seat at Honeywell. You took over Honeywell in February 2002. You weathered the 08-09 Great Recession in the middle of your run. What advice do you have for those of us running companies and how to accelerate growth coming out on the other side?
I guess I'd have more than one piece of advice. The first one to leaders is to not panic. There's a real tendency amongst leaders to read what the herd is thinking and kind of move with the herd. And if there was any time where a leader has to exercise independent thinking, it's a time like this. And it doesn't mean driving for consensus. It means getting all the facts and opinions, being able to make a good independent judgment. The second piece would be to think about recovery at the same time that you're dealing with the recession. As in any recession, everybody is panicking and all they can think about is what are they going to do and making decisions for the short term. And they sometimes forget that no matter how dire things have ever looked, recovery always comes. So be thinking about your growth initiatives, whatever investments you were making, how you maintain your base, how do you treat your customers in particular during this time. But be thinking about recovery at the same time you're reacting to everything.
I know a little bit about what you did in 08 and 09. You really used furloughs at a time most people did not use furloughs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's very interesting to see, Bob, now how many companies are using furloughs. And if you go back to the Great Recession, no big company was using them at all, except for us, that I'm aware of. In fact, as a result of ours, the Harvard Business School wrote a case study about furloughs versus layoffs. And I'd always been kind of nurturing this in the back of my mind, because I've been in businesses where they had laid off a bunch of people, and then they'd hire them back, and it never quite made sense to me. So it cost you 6 months between severance, WARN-ACT, whatever else. Then 6 months to get your money back for that 6 months that they basically weren't doing anything. Then assuming it's an 18-month recession, you get a return of 6 months. And then you're scrambling to hire all those people back because of the recovery. And I found myself thinking about it like a plant and saying, if somebody said, okay, you're going to build this plant, take you 6 months, then 6 months to get your money back to even, you'll get a 6 month return, and then you shut it down. How many people would do that? They'd say, well, that's silly. But we do it with people all the time. So we kind of broke ground on really understanding how to do furloughs. And I was just looking for something that was less costly because you didn't have to pay severance. But I was also thinking about recovery and how could I maintain what I called my industrial base at the time so that I didn't just lose all that knowledge. So we worked our way through and found out it was actually pretty difficult because state by state, the rules were different. Country by country, the rules were different. So you really had to figure it out, but it worked extremely well for us.
How did you think about reintroducing your brands and your products to the marketplace after they have been out of the people's minds during that slowdown?
I would say brand is probably less of an issue for us just because Honeywell is an industrial company. However, the thing that we did do is we looked at the recession, and I wrote this in my share owner's letter saying there's three constituencies you have to manage: customers, employees, and investors. Now, this recession is a bit different just because employees are at a physical risk, so you have to take that into consideration first. And I felt like we had to do a great job with customers first, because if we didn't, both investors and employees would suffer in the long term. Anything that we had committed to customers, we made sure that we prioritized. And after that, then we figured out, all right, it's going to be painful. So you have to figure out what's the best way to manage the pain. And we elected to have both investors and employees share in that. Investors, of course, because while we were able to hold our margin rate flat, which was a significant improvement over past performance, I still saw a decline in earnings. With employees, that's we took the approach to use furloughs instead of layoffs. But we also worked on how could we impact benefits programs like 401k matching, which you also see a lot more of this time through, because that wouldn't affect people in the short term. They could still be getting the salary that they needed in order to survive.
So let me ask you a question about your managers. I think in any of these downturns, every manager by necessity switches their mindset from growth to survive. But as you begin to come out, and as you point out, you should be looking for that recovery. How do you get the managers to flip that mindset from survive to growth?
That ain't easy. I would say we were only about 4 months into the Great Recession when we had them thinking about, okay, how do you handle recovery? And this is where I go back to independent thinking, because as you start to have to make these difficult decisions, you find a lot of your own staff not wanting to make those decisions. And more than once, I had that discussions where I would start off with, look, it's why they call it a recession. They don't call it a party. We have to choose between two bad options, There's no great third choice that's going to materialize. So you kind of have to, between discussion, data, and sometimes just having to say, I'm sorry, but I run the place and I believe this is going to be the right thing to do. It's not a very easy process, but one that has to be managed.
Let me ask you a question about predictions. You've lived through these before. You care to make any prediction about when the recovery begins on this one and the speed at which business returns?
So this is one where I tell every business leader, look, hope for the best, prepare for the worst, because you just don't know. Now, if you said, okay, so given all that, still, what do you think will happen? There's nothing that says the virus has gone away. There's no vaccine on the horizon. So I'd suspect that there is going to be more infection. There are going to be more deaths when we get back in the fall. But I also think there's going to be a realization that we can't keep handling it the way we have. This is just an incredibly costly way to manage this, because right now we're putting an unbelievable burden on the young. All of this is just additional debt, but the economy will come back just because we're going to let people work.
Let me go back a little bit in time. You were a favorite go-to CEO for President Obama in spite of being a registered Republican. I actually think you had more visits to the Obama White House than any other CEO. How did that bond develop?
I got outreach from the Obama administration before they were actually in office. I got this call saying, hey, would you participate in a group of CEOs coming to the White House to talk about the stimulus plan in support of it? And I said, yeah, absolutely. We got to do this. The next day they called and said, well, would you lead the group? And I said, okay. That night they called and said, would you be willing to support it with the press? I said, yeah, sure. So on the eighth day, we had our meeting. Then they said, okay, get ready. We're going in the East Room. Nobody prepared me for what was going to happen. Because when we walked out on that stage, I thought there'd be like four or five reporters. There were 200 cameras, video cameras. So it was kind of an interesting experience. But I was strongly supportive, just like I am now with the spending they've been doing, because you can't have government falling back at a time like this. And I think they appreciated the fact that as a registered Republican, I was willing to come and support what they were doing, because I did think it was the right thing for the country. I was able to develop a feeling of trust with people there. They knew I wouldn't say something that I didn't believe, but they also knew they could get the straight scoop from me without any kind of ideology when it came to what was going on out there or what we ought to be doing.
Your predecessors at Honeywell avoided Washington. You embraced it. Why did you change?
There's a symbiotic relationship between government and business, and neither seems to understand the other all that well. And business cannot be successful without government, and government's not going to be successful without business. And I used to say with government that not only does it regulate, but it enables business. Business cannot ignore government, because all that enabling is going on and we need to be a part of it. So I felt it was important for us to participate, and I devoted a lot of time to it.
Dave, let's go back in time. You and I are the same age, but from opposite ends of the country. You're from the top of the country, little town in New Hampshire. Was it Suncook?
Yep. Named after the Suncook Indians.
Can you describe your early life? Paint a picture of America and New Hampshire.
It was a little French-Canadian mill town enclave in New Hampshire, which occurred throughout New England. So until I was three, I spoke French only. We spoke no English. My mom and dad had eighth grade educations. My mom got a secretarial degree that took her a year to get so that she could get a better job. There weren't a lot of role models, so it was kind of tough just trying to figure out, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go?
Well, it sounds like, though, from your background, that you did learn responsibility early and learn to be industrious. The story goes that you actually went into town to pay the family bills. You were the one that took the cash, and you were still a kid, and would go around to every one of the stores and pay the bills. Is that a real story?
Man, you are good. One of the things that I have always told people is that when they ask a question like, you know, where did you learn all your leadership lessons? And they expect me to name a famous CEO. And I always tell them the same thing is, you know, I learned most of what I needed to know from my mom and dad. They really were terrific and very good at instilling the right kind of values, whether it was hard work, responsibility, you need to be able to take care of yourself and not expect others to do it. My mom would give me the money to pay all the bills in Manchester, which was 12 miles away. I'd get on the bus. I'd go into Manchester, and she had given me all the directions that I had to memorize and pay this much here, make sure you get a receipt, then go to this place. And I never thought too much about it. I just did what she told me. And I think back to my dad always telling us, be a leader, not a follower. My mom always saying, think for yourself. It really instills the right kind of values.
You've got this really interesting journey from high school to college. Got admitted, then you decided you wanted to get on with your life. You worked in your dad's garage. We're thinking about being a carpenter's apprentice with an uncle. Almost joined the Navy. And at the last minute, you were saved by the director of admissions at the University of New Hampshire. You want to tell that story and how that changed your life?
If there's anything you can glean from what you just said, it's that I was anxious to get on with my life and make something of myself, but I was totally directionless. I knew I didn't want to keep living with no money the way I always had. To your point, after bouncing around, enlisting in the Navy, and then backing out the day before I was to be sworn in, thank God that worked that way, I decided, okay, I need to get back into school. It seems to be the only thing I'm good at. And I wasn't good as a mechanic. I wasn't good as a carpenter's apprentice. So I drove to the University of New Hampshire, about 45 minutes away, found the director of admissions. I went to their office, and if you recall these kind of days, Bob, I had my jeans, my flannel shirt, my long hair, and went in and said, I'd like to speak to the director of admissions. She said, well, I'm sorry, you don't have an appointment. And I said, no, that's okay. I'll just sit here and wait. I'm sure he's bound to have some time at some point. So after about 2 hours of sitting there, she came over and said, you know, he's not going to be able to see you. And I said, no problem. I brought a book. I can wait. Whenever he leaves, I'll catch him. And she finally looked at me and said, you're not leaving, are you? Well, she finally said, okay, he'll see you. So I went into his office and explained the whole thing. And he said, okay, well, this is not consistent with our rules. However, if you get me an application in by the end of the week, if it qualifies, I'll let you in. So I hustled, got it in through him, and he let me in. I always say that in the arrogance of youth, I didn't think to really thank him. And it was years later that I said, geez, you know, I ought to track that guy down. He really did something special for me. And I did. His name was Gene Savage. And I reconnected with him, thanked him, and come to find out, I was not the only person he'd ever saved like this. He was just that kind of guy. And it was about 3 years after that, he was awarded New Hampshire's highest civilian honor, called the Petty Medal. And he asked me to be the guy presenting it to him.
Breaking the rules does work sometimes.
Yeah, it does. Too many people just kind of get into enforcing the rules and don't really think sometimes about, well, you know, what's really the right thing to do here?
Well, there's a lesson in that, I think, for business, too, and it sounds like you've used it a lot in your career.
I have, and that includes giving people a second chance when things are warranted. And I benefited from second chances, and I always kept that in mind.
Just hold on a second, because we've got so much more to talk about. We'll be back after a quick break. Welcome back to Math and Magic.
You had an interesting path through college. You worked full-time at night. You did college in the day. You took a year off to become a commercial fisherman. Fortunately, you came back to your senses, finished college. You joined GE after college and began to move up the ranks. When in that process did you realize you had real management potential?
Actually, I was working at GE as an hourly employee nights while I went to school those last couple of years. I graduated, and I went back to school just because I got scared. I got married, and we were living in this third floor, unheated, uninsulated apartment in New Hampshire, which means, yeah, it gets chilly in the winter. And first month, my wife says she's pregnant. And then fourth month, she said she couldn't work anymore. And I realized, oh, my God, we have to live on my paycheck now as an hourly employee. And about 4 weeks after I graduated, they let me interview for an exempt job, and I got it. And I started kind of just working from that point. And all I wanted was a job that would pay more than the last one. Just as I felt I was making some progress, I ended up getting divorced. That put me back in the hole again. So it probably took me until I was 30 before I finally got to a point where I said, finally, I could pay my bills and not worry. The idea of becoming a CEO didn't really dawn on me until I was about 40 years old. And I was in a job and said, son of a gun, I think I'm actually not so bad at this. I think there'd be a chance for me to do something somewhere. And that's the first time I ever really thought about it. Up to that point, it was just a matter of get a job that pays more so I don't have to worry.
You wound up running the GE Appliance unit very successfully, a $6 billion business. There was a very visible succession process when Jack Welch was going to step down. Looking back on that process, was that a good way to look for a successor? I mean, Jack says it didn't work. It was a mistake for him. He missed you.
Well, it's nice to hear you say that. I have to say that when I went through my own succession process, I read a lot of literature trying to make sure that I did it right. I didn't want to make a mistake. I wanted the company to do well 10 years after I left. I really wanted to build an institution. One of the things that kind of struck me is how really weak the literature is out there. And I read a lot of stuff where they talk about this company's great succession process. And then you'd say, yeah, but you know, that guy got fired 4 years later. So how good is the process if it yields a bad result? So I took a different approach and went through a bunch of interviews with retired CEOs, some of whom it had worked, some for whom it had not, and asked them what did they miss, what did they like that they had done, what would they have done differently, and developed my own process.
Well, shareholders clearly appreciate it because the company kept growing, is doing a good job, which I think is a testament to the legacy you built, but also that succession plan. When you left GE, you went to TRW, but left pretty quickly to go be CEO of Honeywell in early 2002. Well, why that jump?
TRW as a company was fraught with difficulty. They had fired the three previous successors. So when I went there, I said, we're going to set up something so that if I'm not made CEO by a certain date, you'll have to pay me $10 million. Now, most people would look at that and go, oh, okay, well, that's not going to happen. It nearly did. They damn near fired me. And the CEO went to the board demanding that I be fired. I ended up going through a three-month investigation by the board to find out who was right here. Well, the board ended up deciding that I was the right call. So they did end up making me CEO, but they still didn't make my life that easy after that. Tom Neff reached out to me in like December of 01 and then said, hey, would you be interested in looking at the Honeywell job? And at first I said no and said, look, I've just started here. There's a lot of things I got to get done and I just, you know, wouldn't feel right about it. And he said, well, I'll send you a bunch of stuff. Take a look. Give me a call. So he sent it to me and I read all the stuff, watched the videos, and I found myself thinking, why was I being so loyal to a group of people who had exhibited no loyalty towards me? And I thought, okay, this is a better opportunity. I ought to give it a try and see what I can do. So I elected to join. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but as bad as it looked externally, it was even worse internally. For the first 4.5 months that I was the CEO, I was not allowed to see the books. And when I would ask a finance guy, how's the quarter going? They literally said, I'm sorry, I've been instructed not to answer any of those questions from you.
Wow.
Okay, well, I'll be chairman in 4.5 months and I'll find out everything then. So I waited, and of course, it was significantly worse than what anybody had thought internally or externally. And it's one of the things that, you know, getting back to this point on succession planning, Jack Welch, at the end of the day, his 20 years were an amazing run. And I thought, geez, you know, what was different is he was able to figure it out. Whatever it was, however the future unfolded, he was able to figure it out. Then I looked at it and said, well, you know, I kind of ran into the same thing. What I ran into at Honeywell was a lot different than what I'd been told and people externally thought, but I was able to figure it out. And it became one of the kind of big things I looked for in a successor was not trying to predict the future, because 6 months ago, who would have predicted that we are where we are now? You just don't know. But rather, can you find somebody who can figure it out?
Well, it's interesting. I've heard people say, and I probably more in that camp, is you actually can't plan for the future. Plans don't come true. They just reduce your anxiety because you think you can. You know, just to put it in perspective for people too, you know, before you arrived, Honeywell was supposed to be acquired by GE. And I think the government in Europe called it off. And it seems like Honeywell was not prepared to continue to run as an independent company. Was that what you were dealing with in terms of the backstory there?
To your point, the EU put conditions on that GE refused to comply with. So the deal fell apart, then Honeywell sued GE for failure to close the deal, and there was a small settlement. And in the end, by the way, both GE and Honeywell took it to the European Court in The Hague, and they agreed that the EU had overstepped in their compliance request. So it's a little piece of the story that ends up getting lost. But yeah, that definitely ended up happening, and the GE folks were pretty much running the company, and there were whole organizations that had been told, look, you're going to be restructured out of a job, so you ought to be looking now, and if you can find a job, take it. So we had something like a third of our leadership positions were empty.
A hell of a beginning. It ended well.
It was a lot messier than people ever thought about, and I developed some of that in the book.
Let's talk a second about company culture. You mentioned it earlier when we were talking about this downturn. You know, some people call it the operating system of a company. If it's not right, none of the programs are going to work well. How do you think about company culture, and how do you develop it?
Yeah, I got to completely agree on how important it is. And I realized we had warring cultures because we had the legacy Allied Signal, legacy Pitway, legacy Honeywell, all with different views on how the world ought to work. So first thing we did is said, okay, we need to focus on something outside of ourselves. So we chose the customer. And so let's make all our arguments consistent with what's best for the customer. And if we did that, then maybe that would take a lot of the emotion out of it. The second one was to develop 12 behaviors that said, okay, here's what we want our culture to be. And I did that with my staff. And I remember one of my staff members saying, Dave, why are we spending all this time on behaviors when we have all these strategic issues we need to address? And my comment to him was, look, I can make all the strategic decisions you want, but if nobody does them, it really isn't going to make a difference. We'll feel better because we've made some decisions, but nothing's going to happen. And what we need is a culture where after decisions are made, something happens. The thing that people like is to be part of something bigger than themselves that's successful. And if we can do that, people will feel good. If they can see that their job, the thing that they're doing every day makes a difference, that's the sort of thing that builds morale. And I spent a lot of time talking about it, a lot of time implementing it, the Honeywell operating system, which was very consistent with our culture, managed to touch half our people as a way of motivating them, creating more fulfilling work. And that culture does make a difference. I'm a very big believer in it.
You did something very few CEOs do. You left at the peak. You couldn't have been more successful, more powerful, more applauded. And talk a little bit about how you came to that decision.
I did love my job. I loved doing it. It was a labor of love for me. I mean, I loved working at Honeywell and the people and what we accomplished there. But I had a couple of things that I thought were important. The first one was I really wanted 10 years after I left for people to say, wow, that Honeywell is a great company. It just keeps delivering. Those guys keep performing. And while I had, I thought, good people, good process, good portfolio, I also thought it was going to be really important to pick the right CEO. And that's why I put as much attention into it as I did. If you have really good potential successors, they're not going to sit in a job for 5 years waiting to see if they're going to get the job or not. Because recruiters are knocking on their door constantly. You need to be able to create a tighter timeline so that your good people are going to stick with you to see what the decision is. The other piece of it was, I knew 2016 was going to be our toughest year because we'd won piles of aerospace contracts and it required a lot of what we call concessions. And I had changed the bookkeeping, no longer put it on the balance sheet and instead expense all that stuff. And a bunch of those expenses were coming in 2016. And then I knew 2017 onward were going to be better. And I thought, okay, better for me to take that year so that the tougher year is on me and my reputation can stand it. And then for my successor to take it from that point forward where there's a little bit more of a tailwind. So I put all those together and said, okay, this is going to be the right time to go if I really want 10 years from now, people to look back and go, man, that Honeywell's a great company.
Well, it looks like you're on that path and you handled it very well. You've got a book coming out. Why did you do a book? What do you want people to take away from your book?
What I really wanted to do is kind of my joke about business books is that just about every business book I've read would have made a great pamphlet that there's 10 pages of important concept and then 250 pages of stories to support it that you can fly right through. And I said, I wanted something where at least every other page had something thought provoking where someone would say, oh, that's an idea. I could use that, or I could do this over here, or geez, maybe I should modify how I'm doing something. So I wanted to write something that was just very meaty, very substantive. And one of the things that has bothered me is all this discussion of short-termism. It always comes across like you're either short-term focused or you're long-term focused. It's mutually exclusive. And the way we ran Honeywell was that I always said success comes from accomplishing two seemingly conflicting things at the same time. And it's simplistic when people say, I'm either short-term focused or I'm long-term focused. You have to find a way to do both. So how do you accomplish both?
So let's jump to you again. If someone listening to this episode would like a career like you've had, is there one piece of advice you could give them that puts them on that track?
I guess everybody's going to be different because a capability is different. I might have really wanted to beat Usain Bolt in the 100-meter dash. I don't care how good my attitude was. I'd have still been at the 50-meter mark when he was finishing. It wasn't going to happen. So make sure you're working on the right thing. Hard work doesn't always pay off. So make sure whatever you're working on is consistent with what you're capability is. The second piece I guess I'd add is I always said advancement requires two things. Performance, you got to be able to get results and get them in the right way, and visibility. And visibility cuts both ways. If you do a great job and it's visible, then you'll do great. If you fail, well, that's also going to be pretty visible. And I can't help it. I guess I got to add a third piece. If you are going to get ahead, it's important to be self-aware and to be a learner. And that all of us have personal characteristics that are issues to our advancement. Only you can figure out what that is. You'll get advice from other people, and sometimes it'll be correct, sometimes it won't. but you really have to figure it out for yourself. It took me until I was 40 years old to realize that when everybody said I tended to be defensive, they were right. And I realized I had to start thinking differently about how I handle things. And it made me a better leader because I realized that that's the kind of person I was, and I needed to be able to control how I reacted to things in a way that would yield better decisions.
Dave, this has been a great conversation. As we wrap up, we always end every Math and Magic episode with a shout out to those two key disciplines of marketing and business, which is the analytics and the sheer creativity. You've seen a lot of people. If you think about it, who would you give the shout out to? They can be a complete unknown or they can be somebody in history of the greatest analytical business person you could think of.
Bob Rubin, a former Goldman Sachs and Secretary of the Treasury, but he wrote a book called In an Uncertain World. And it really had an impact on me because he talked about how we all look at issues, then make a decision and assume that we've made the right decision and we just kind of go forward. And his point was, in every decision where maybe maximizing the probability we made the right decision, but we need to recognize that there's uncertainty in everything and that there are other outcomes that are possible. So how do you think about those? That had a real impact on me.
The most creative. Who would you give the shout out to for the magician? Just comes up with those great ideas out of nowhere.
Well, how about Bernie Madoff?
Oh, gosh. Okay, we're going to give it to him, but we're going to put that on the side in the box and not reward him too much.
He stole billions without anybody noticing. Talk about a magician.
Dave, thank you so much for being here today, and good luck with the book. And thank you for sharing these experiences and these insights.
Oh, it was fun, Bob. Thanks.
Here are a few things I picked up in my conversation with Dave. One, think about recovery during recession. Dave was in the driver's seat at Honeywell during the last two big economic downturns, and no matter how dire things got, he always thought about the long-term impact of his decisions. As Dave said, thinking about your growth initiatives, investments, and how to maintain your customers are crucial to a company's longevity. Two, exercise independent thinking. While it's important to gather everyone's facts and opinions, it's imperative that leaders make independent decisions during difficult times, even if it's not among the consensus. As Dave says, independent thinking is a rare but important commodity. Three, don't try to be something you're not. As Dave recounted, he went back to school because he knew he was good at it, and that mindset carried with him throughout his career. He always stuck to the path he felt most called to. It's a lesson he learned early in life to always trust what you're good at. And four, break the rules. Sometimes enforcing the rules isn't always the right thing to do. And because Dave dared to do so, he got a second chance to attend college, which changed the course of his life.
Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Pittman.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio. The show is hosted by Bob Pittman. Special thanks to Sue Schillinger for booking and wrangling our wonderful talent, which is no small feat. Nikki Etor for pulling research, Bill Plax and Michael Azar for their recording help, our editor Ryan Murdoch, and of course, Gail, Raul, Eric, Angel, Noel, Mango, and everyone who helped bring this show to your ears. Until next time.